Antebo tas pickad upp.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And we're live on the air. Now, I'm not promising an especially good show today because I'm having some kind of problem. I don't know what it is, but I'm experiencing stabbing pains in my right ear. I'm concerned that I may have an ear infection. I tried earlier the god-awful sinus irrigator. I think that's its official name. One of these things where you squirt salt water up your nose, and it runs back out the other nostril, at least in theory. Sometimes that helps, but I'm not sure it did much this time. So, I don't mean to just describe to you whatever is wrong with me. I'm just attempting to explain to you why, if this is not the best show that you have ever experienced from me, an idea of why. Okay. Let's see. Oh, MNW has returned from meeting hell. That's nice. So, this is an announcement I keep meaning to make, and I've been making it during my Hear Now the Words dial-in shows, but I think I may have failed to make it during A Step Farther Out. So I am currently outside the United States, and as it turns out, the postal rates from here to places outside the United States are significantly lower than they are from inside the United States. So if you are outside the United States and you would like to receive a copy, a DVD, screener DVD of the motion picture Lunar Sea, 2012 Canadian documentary, in which I appeared, along with a variety of other interesting people, including the late, great Alan Bean, fourth man to walk on the moon, commander of the second Skylab crew, and painter. If you'd like to see that movie, it's very, very likely that the easiest way is just to ask me for a copy. And so email me, I guess, Papa Uniform Bravo Lima India Uniform Sierra at Sierra Delta Foxtrot.org, Publius@SDF.org, and request one, and I'll happily send it to you. I don't ask for money for this service. Obviously, if once you get the package that I send you, you like what you're getting, and you really feel that what I'm doing deserves some material support, I'm always happy to receive that. But I do not ask for money. I mean, it wouldn't be right of me to do so. I'm not the copyright holder of the movie. I just happen to be in a position to give away copies of it, and you're not likely to be able to see it any other way, except possibly if you're in Canada, you may be able to get it through the CBC documentary channel or some kind of on-demand service. Not really sure about that. So yes, last week, good old last week, I suggested that many of the ways we think about sex and sexual behavior and sexuality, we might have to modify those if we wish to avoid future wars. And war, honestly, is the great catastrophe, which we must avoid. I would argue that pretty much any other trouble that we as humans get into, we can get out of by the use of scientific technology and reason and those other kinds of things. But in warfare, we're turning our tools against ourselves. And we've got really good tools these days, and we can pretty much destroy everything that we value. And I would urge everyone not to do that. I'm sorry to say, however, that probably the solution is not quite as simple as make love, not war. Great slogan. There's probably something in it, but very likely it's more complex and difficult to implement than that. Because isn't everything always more complex and difficult to implement than that? Tin from Berlin says, shooting Putin into space would probably help avert war. As long as we can dress it up in, hey, you've been such a great leader, we can just, we're going to give you an all-expenses-paid trip to Saturn in recognition of how great you are. I mean, from the very first time that I went out in public, to try and evangelize people about lunar settlement, I got asked things like, can we send, insert name of politician, presidential candidates particularly. Also, my bratty 12-year-old daughter and her whiny 13-year-old friends. That was another good one. Also, people's ex-husbands, very commonly. Shooting people into space sort of generically is not really my solution for avoiding war. I do think, however, that we have... There's a phrase that sometimes gets used, the moral equivalent of war, that space efforts are something that can mobilize people. They require a lot of technical effort. They give people a goal to work towards, right? They give people something to aspire to. And, of course, there are direct and indirect benefits of enormous variety. Let's see. In space news today, people are talking about a SpaceX booster, which is probably going to crash into the moon. A second stage from a Falcon 9, which was used to launch a climate-observing satellite into a Lagrangian point orbit more than 5 years ago now. And Lagrangian point orbits are, of course, if you're putting a satellite into an orbit, generally speaking, the booster you use to put the satellite into that orbit goes into a very similar orbit. That's just natural, really. And otherwise, you have to have quite a lot of propellant on the satellite or some kind of other system to move it where it's going. Now, there have been satellites with electric propulsion. So it's not unheard of, right? But in general, you wind up putting the booster into something closely resembling the satellite's final orbit. And so unless you take measures to deorbit it, it'll sort of hang out there. Well, the Lagrangian points in the Earth-Moon system are sort of these, they're really metastable, right? In a pure three-body system, they would be stable points, but they're not because of the influence of the sun. And so what happens is that if you put something out there which doesn't have thrusters and active control, it'll sort of wander around there's a plane, essentially, which you can plot of constant energy orbits. And so this booster has been sort of wandering around this interface surface, as it's sometimes referred to, between the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun for some years now, about 7 years, 6-7 years. And so very soon it's expected, within the next couple of months, it's expected to smack into the moon, probably on the far side, because that's sort of how these orbital dynamics problems solve. Now, a lot of people are talking about this, which I find amusing, sort of the way that they wind up talking about it, because some people are talking like, oh, this is the first time a rocket stage has ever slammed into the moon. Well, that's completely wrong. I mean, absolutely, completely, 100% wrong. Lots of things have slammed into the moon. The U.S. even had a whole series of spacecraft, the Ranger probes, the whole purpose of which was to slam into the lunar surface, taking photographs on the way down. And the impact was itself a part of the scientific investigation. Is that, how does that work? Well, the answer is that they wanted to know what the lunar surface was composed of, what its behavior was, whether you could actually land on it. And so the radio noise, if a radio transmitter hits a surface, in the moment before it stops transmitting, the sudden Doppler shift will tell you what its acceleration was like. Let's see, MNW wants to know if that's the same Lagrangian point as the Webb telescope headed to, and the answer is no. The James Webb Space Telescope is actually at the Earth, at an Earth-Sun Lagrangian libration point, Earth-Sun L2. But Earth-Sun L2 is, of course, on the far side of the Earth from the Sun. And basically, it's just parked out there because parking it any closer to the Earth, the cryogenic systems would waste a lot of cooling effort. Because if you're at all familiar with thermodynamics, you know that getting rid of heat by radiation or absorbing heat by radiation all depends on the difference between you and the background temperature raised to the 4th power. So if you're at all close to the Earth, a big chunk of your surroundings is occupied by the Earth at, 300 kelvins or so. And if you're trying to keep your sensitive thermal infrared detectors cooled down to 20 or 30 kelvins, you've got a problem. Whereas if you move out to Earth-Sun L2, the Earth is a dinky little feature, and you can block both it and the sun with a reflective shield, and then your surroundings consist primarily of space at about 3 kelvins average temperature, and it's much easier to cool. Anyway, but the point being that this SpaceX booster is going to slam into the lunar surface, and in the 1960s and 70s, we actually did that repeatedly, deliberately, because the impact of the Apollo upper stages, S-4B stages, and the spent lunar lander stages, lunar lander ascent stages, was used to calibrate, provide known reference input signals for the seismometers left behind as part of the Apollo lunar surface scientific experiment packages. Sadly, those packages are no longer in operation. Now, by this point, the plutonium-238 radioisotope thermoelectric generators that powered them might be non-functional, not because of the plutonium-238 decaying so much as because of the thermoelectric elements breaking down. I'm not sure one way or the other. The ones on the Pioneer and Voyager spacecraft seem to be good for a very long time, but of course they haven't had to deal with the constant thermal cycling caused by being in daylight part of the time and darkness part of the time. Right. They've had a very, very constant temperature environment over, 44 years for the Voyagers? Anyway. But the United States basically stopped listening to and turned off those Apollo scientific stations years ago. Now, here's a question. The last people to actually land anything on the lunar surface were the Chinese, right? So, do they have seismographs on their landers? I don't know if they've talked about that at all. If they do have seismometers, okay. If they do have seismometers, are those seismometers still working? That's another useful one. Incidentally, if you sort of search, do web searches, you'll find out that you'll find a lot of articles about the famous Chinese seismometer of the Han Dynasty, which was a elaborate device involving dragon heads and bronze frogs and so forth, which would indicate the size and sort of the size and direction of an earthquake, which is, you know, pretty neat. But yeah, so if the Chinese landers have seismographs, and if those seismographs are still working, then perhaps we could get some useful information out of this impact. It's kind of funny. But that's where you are. MNW says, requiescat in pace, science in the United States. Of course, funny story. Friend of my parents, actually, a guy named Bill Jolitz. And if you're into BSD, you've probably heard of Bill Jolitz as one of the authors of 386 BSD, which is pretty much the ancestor of modern OpenBSD, FreeBSD, and NetBSD. So, what's the deal with Bill Jolitz? Why am I even mentioning him? Well, the answer basically is that, according to my folks, and this is more of a vintage comp topic, really, than a step farther out topic, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. I try not to talk about computers mostly on this show, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. See, the thing is, Bill Jolitz dropped out of high school to go to work for NASA back before the United States stopped supporting mad science. I mean, back in the 1960s, the United States had a robust mad science effort. You don't realize this, right? At the same time that we were landing on the moon, right, at the same time that the United States had the Apollo program to send people to the moon, the United States also had a program to manufacture transplutonium elements in industrial quantities. Nothing says mad science like visible quantities of fermium. Californium, einsteinium, berkelium, all those things, right? The U.S. was trying to manufacture some of them in kilogram quantities, which turns out to be quite difficult. But, alas, during the Nixon, Ford, and Carter administrations, that sort of effort basically collapsed. Tin from Berlin asks, does the end of the mad scientist program coincide with German scientists entering retirement? Well, it's kind of the other way around, actually, that Wernher von Braun left NASA in disgust after he realized that Nixon was curtailing the post-Apollo programs, that Apollo applications, space stations, that kind of thing, Mars missions, this were just gone, the space shuttle would be a shadow of itself, etc. And so von Braun said, goodbye, I'm taking my marbles and going home. And he went to, of all places, the Congo. And you ask, why was he going to the Congo? which might have been called Zaire at the time. It sort of went back and forth. Well, the short answer is he and a bunch of other disgruntled old German rocket scientists had put together a company called OTRAG, and they were going to try and build really, really cheap space launch vehicles comprised of welded steel modules, pressure-fed rocket engines burning nitric acid and kerosene. The Soviets then paid off the Angolans to invade the Congo and started an extraordinarily bloody war that lasted for many years. Why? Well, from what I can figure out, it was that the Soviets were absolutely terrified of a bunch of Germans having a rocketry program which could, in principle, be used as an intercontinental ballistic missile program, although it would be a pretty stupid thing to do, a bunch of Germans having a rocketry program that was not supervised by the United States. They figured that the United States would sort of keep them in line. Anyway, so after the Angolans invaded, then the OTRAG folks attempted to set up in northern Sweden for a while, didn't really succeed there. And then they were invited to Libya by Muammar Gaddafi. And when they got there, Gaddafi simply stole all their stuff and deported them. Which was dumb because, of course, it's not like he was going to get a useful missile program out of that. Because if you really want a missile program, you've got to actually keep around the scientists and engineers. Come on, how dumb can you be? So, you know, scientists, engineers, you know, the United States, of course, has been for decades now, it seems, dependent on immigrants. And what happens if the Indians and Chinese stop coming? What happens if the Indian and Chinese governments say you're not allowed? Or what happens if somebody else offers them a better deal? That could pose a problem, couldn't it? I just want to throw that out there. Other things I want to talk about. Well, I mean, of course, I was talking about we really need to not have wars. And people don't seem to get that. You know, we've got rising tensions in Eastern Europe, Western Asia. We've also got a lot of other things going on, though. There's a lot of things that it's real complex, right? So things that are really complex and hard to understand. Why is the Lithuanian government so angry about the construction of a nuclear power plant in Belarus? Partly, I suppose, it was because they were forced to shut down their own nuclear power plant, Ignalina, as a condition of joining the European Union. And they went from being a net exporter of electricity on a large scale, which actually contributed substantially to their balance of payments, to being an importer. They had a plan for a while to build their own nuclear power plant, but it hasn't happened. And so the Belarusians, well, the Russians are building a nuclear power plant in Belarus, and it's practically on the Lithuanian border. And the Lithuanians are going around telling everybody that this plant is going to explode, it's going to be worse than Chernobyl, it's going to contaminate everything, everyone's going to be dead forever, which is really kind of weird, honestly. I mean, a major reason that it's being built close to the Lithuanian border, if you look at the maps, is being built fairly close to where Ignalina was, which suggests that it's being built at the far end of a major electrical tie line, right? A big bulk power line. Now, especially since the Lithuanians, Latvians, and Estonians are planning to disconnect from the old Soviet supergrid in 2025, it makes sense that you want a large, stable power generator as far out on that interconnector as possible. Why do you want that? Well, we can look at what happened in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan earlier in the week as an example of that. Now, I'm sure you heard about the political unrest in Kazakhstan, which came close to bringing down the government. They brought in foreign troops from Russia and so on, which apparently actually left after a week. That was kind of interesting. But yeah, that nearly toppled the government. It was all over the question of gas prices, specifically liquefied petroleum gas, what we Americans are in the lazy habit of referring to as propane, which is its major constituent. Anyway, that's a major motor fuel. That's what people use on their cars in Kazakhstan. Anyway, the government was going to raise prices on that. People were naturally upset about that, etc. There was a bunch of unrest. Okay, so thing is, apparently, it's not just motor fuel. There's stress on other sources of energy. For example, droughts cause stress on electricity production. And apparently also a bunch of Bitcoin miners have moved to Kazakhstan after they were thrown out of China. And there's a big electrical tie line which allows Kazakhstan to bring in power from Russia. But it went unstable and disconnected. And there was a massive blackout which basically shut down Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, which is a vast amount of area, not with a whole lot of people in it, but a vast amount of area. Now, Kazakhstan is basically the world's leading exporter of uranium, and it has no nuclear power plants. So this is the funny thing. Canada, Australia, and Kazakhstan, three major producers of uranium in the world. Canada has nuclear power plants, which use natural uranium. They can use their own product. Australia has a law against nuclear power plants. Kazakhstan simply has none. If they did have nuclear power, they wouldn't be so dependent on that tie line to Russia. They wouldn't be so dependent on hydro, and they wouldn't be having to burn gas, which is a major export for them. So they probably would be in a better position economically and politically all around. Now, what else can we say? Rolly asks, why long-term would be a bad idea for Russia to go into the Ukraine? Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, but I will try and point out at least one. When the Soviet Union broke up, Ukraine had a massive quantity of nuclear weapons. Ukraine manufactured missiles. Ukraine was the site of major military bases. Ukraine was bulging at the seams with nuclear weapons. They gave up those nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees from the U.S., from Russia, from other powers, right, who all said that in exchange for Ukraine giving up strategic nuclear forces, that Ukraine's territorial boundaries would be inviolate, that no one would take military action against Ukraine, etc. Well, 5-7 years ago, Putin decided to just throw that all out the window. And that's a real problem. Because in the future, countries like Iran or North Korea, India, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, you know, is a worry for me. Did you know that South Africa... Rolly might know this. Did you know that South Africa actually built nuclear weapons during the late 70s, early 80s? It was a deep, dark secret at the time. But the de Klerk government, the last government before majority rule, decided to destroy them all. There are still people who claim that was the wrong decision, it was purely racism, that they didn't want to see black Africans with atomic bombs. I'm not a fan of that argument. I understand where people are coming from, but I'm not a fan of that argument. Anyway, the thing is, if you say, give up your nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees and other benefits, which is basically the whole idea of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, then going ahead and having one of the nuclear weapons states of the Non-Proliferation Treaty violate that in the most egregious way? I mean, that's the best advertisement you can have for pulling out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and making atomic bombs, isn't it? Anyway, of course, the other half of that is the United States has been violating the NPT for many, many years. But on the other side of it, basically, the promise was that the nuclear weapons states would give the non-weapons states lots and lots of help developing nuclear energy for their national economies. And the U.S. has done exactly the opposite. The U.S. has tried, ever since the Carter administration, really even the Ford administration, sort of, to blockade the use of nuclear energy. It's been an explicit policy goal to discourage countries from using nuclear energy, despite the fact that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, having been ratified by the Senate, is actually above all federal legislation. That's a fun thing, right? Anyway, you've been listening to Step Farther Out on SDF Anon Radio, and in 5 seconds, the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
7.